I want to add my word of welcome to all of you, and especially Randy and Kitty. It's been a long time having you away, and it's wonderful to have you back. Now, for the benefit of some of you who have not been with us, let me try to set the stage for what we're doing. We have now, for a little over a year, been looking at lists in the Bible and trying to learn from those lists things that will help us understand things better. We are looking now at a set of three lists, one from James, one from Galatians, and one eventually from Matthew, of characteristics of Jesus. This comes out of a workbook by T.W. Hunt. The workbook looks like this. This is my copy. You go get your own. In this workbook, he has taken the point of view that when Jesus talked about in the Sermon on the Mount there being a narrow way and a broad way, the broad way, many people find it, but it leads to death. The narrow way, not many people find it, but it leads to life. He's picked up on that idea to say a narrow way always has a possibility of falling off on one side and of falling off on another side. And so these characteristics of Jesus tend to have an opposite, and Satan's work is to try to pull us to the opposite if he can. That's not successful. Satan will very often try to push us into some perversion of that, and that is almost as bad in terms of taking us away from that central walk. And so we've been looking at a series of words. The words that we're looking at come in this set, this middle set, out of the fruit of the Spirit. And we're looking this morning at the word meekness. Now, that is not as familiar a word to some of you as it might be. And so in order to set the stage for this, I want us to look at a couple of different verses of Scripture. I have them written up here for you. And so if you will, either look up or prepare to listen to Matthew 11:29. In most translations, it will not have the word meek. It will have a different word. In the King James, it will have the word meek. But Jesus says, "Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek." Other translations will say humble, or perhaps gentle, and lowly of heart. That allows us to begin the process of putting some words up here. Words like humble, or humble and gentle, lowly of heart, if you go to Psalm 37, if you have your Bibles and can find Psalm 37, if you see somebody near you that doesn't have one, you share. But in Psalm 37, there's this phrase in the King James Version that says, "The meek will inherit the earth and will enjoy the good things thereof." This particular translation gives it like this: "The poor will have the land for their own and enjoy untroubled peace. The wicked will not be there." In this case, translated poor, I think you may look forward to Matthew when it talks about poor in spirit as something not too far from this. But it says the meek will inherit the earth, and we're going to try to at least set the stage for exploring that. Perhaps of more interest is Psalm 25. Verse 9 in one translation says, "He will guide the meek," or the humble, "in judgment, and he will teach his ways to the poor." Offer God's guidance to people who have this characteristic. My personal favorite is Psalm 149. We'll take a look at Psalm 149. I like the way one translation renders this. My translation, the first line says, "The Lord loves his people." And the second line, "He will crown the humble," or the meek, with salvation. But one translation says he will beautify the meek in salvation. There's something really nice about that translation. Okay? Now, I want to go back and pick up on Matthew 11. Jesus identified himself with this term, for I am meek and lowly of heart. Take my yoke upon you, learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart. Take a look at Numbers chapter 12, verse 3. Numbers chapter 12. The context for this is in Numbers chapter 12, verse 1. Aaron and Miriam, that was Moses' brother and sister, were criticizing him. And it says at the end of verse 2, the Lord heard this. And the comment in verse 3, most commentators think, is God's comment on the situation. King James, I think, says, Moses was extremely meek, the meekest man on earth. Mine says he was extremely humble, the humblest man on earth. Do you associate Moses with meekness? Because if you don't, then the first thing we got to do is sort of recast what the word meek or meekness means in order to make it fit. And I think that. So, see what you can do with putting up some more terms here. I can't even read that myself. Let me try writing that again. What other terms might you put up for this?
Unassuming.
That's going to turn out to be a huge part of what we work on today. Willing to be instructed, I think you said.
Kind.
I think I saw your name. Patient and then Jeff.
Yielding.
Which one? They're not quite the same.
Yielding.
I think so. Yielded. Patient. Yielded and patient. What else? Jeff.
I always equated it to subservient.
Okay. And if you'll allow me, this is one of those that I think may belong more to the boundary between this. It sort of depends on how you carry that thought, how you carry that into action. And I'll try to show you what I mean in just a second. That we didn't come in with that word, but we came into a concept that's pretty close to them. Remember what Jeremiah says about people being like clay? What's the rest of that? Moldable, right? Okay. But where we went in the first hour when we were dealing with this idea was that you could have the concept of conforming or responding to God's call to be flexible to God versus conforming to the world. And the world is real good at that.
Romans 12.
Read it.
Romans 12. So do not conform yourselves to the standards of this world, but let God transform your inward.
Yeah, that was what was in my mind, was that verse. I'd forgotten where it was. But the concept of subservient, I think, is one of those that depending on how it's worked out, it can fall in more than one place. Okay. Now, I'll tell you, if you go through T.W. Hunt's workbook, you'll find him giving synonyms, if you will, for the same word. He'll give some terms that are opposites, and then he'll give some terms that are perversion, sort of going the other direction but going too far. And in most of those cases, he gives you a word. Every once in a while, he might give you two words. This is the first time where he only gives you three or four, and they're all long phrases. And I think that's actually reflecting how difficult it is to catch in words what this term is actually meaning. One of the things he says is accepting God's dealings with us as good and without resistance. Do you remember what Job said when his wife came and said, listen, all these disasters, all that's left for you is to curse God and die. Remember what he said to her? We accept good things from God's hand. Must we not accept the hard times as well? And the comment was, in all this, he did not sin. Lowly before God, humble before men, is another one of these long phrases that T.W. Hunt put forward. In the first hour, I didn't have time to do this, but maybe we've got time in here. Do you remember some of the lists, the characteristics of love as listed in 1 Corinthians 13? Remember those? Does not brag. Is not arrogant. Does not act unbecomingly. Doesn't seek his own. Is not easily provoked. Doesn't keep an account of wrongs done to it. All of those, one way or another, begin to describe some of this. Someone with meekness is not easily provoked. Okay. What are some opposites?
Brash.
I heard brash.
Arrogant.
Arrogant.
No, no. Yeah, and any of these, you might see the word as arrogant, or you might say arrogance. You can sort of pick which form of the word. Arrogant. What was the somebody?
I just didn't know it all.
Yeah.
I'm not able to explain.
Rigid.
Self-centered.
I can't get them all down. I heard rigid. I heard self-centered. And I think I heard one more, but I don't remember.
Reactionary.
Well, that's a big word.
Break that one
out for us. Whoever said that.
What do you mean by that one?
Yeah.
Just, it goes with know-it-all. Just very quick to come out right at you, right with an opinion before listening or sensing or trying.
If I say quick with
quick, that's good.
An opinion.
Impulsive.
An opinion that you ought to have almost as quick. I work with people like that sometimes. Mercifully, not all of them, but enough of them to make it interesting. Yeah, don't look at her when you say that.
Demanding.
Maybe Hunt put down a couple of words that you might find interesting. He put down haughty and prideful, which I think are interesting words. And he also put down cockiness, egotism, vanity, and conceit. At which point I started thinking, I think I should have thought about Carly Simon, but I didn't own that album. Do you know what covering a song means? It means somebody else records it after somebody has recorded it first, and then they make a lot more money, and the poor person makes almost nothing. Dreamgirls and a whole bunch of recent films have sort of hinged on that kind of thing. But the version I heard was on an album called Tapestry by Carole King. And she sings a song which has this phrase in it. You're so vain, you probably think this song is about you. And of course, in one particular case, the person would be right. So, vanity and conceited sort of go along with this. Pride more than anything. Sort of falling into place there, I think.
I never thought of me. I always thought of someone like verbally quiet. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, let's go to perversions for a moment. Both Jesus and Moses identified with this characteristic as perhaps one of the most important characteristics they could possibly be noted as having. Mm-hmm. Right? That is not what we usually associate with that word. So if you push this past this, away from pride to a perversion of this, where do you go?
Weak.
Spineless.
Yeah, I went to doormat, I went to spineless.
What the whip?
There was a point in the history of University of Richmond where some people that I worked with who were about to retire said we should get a new flag for the campus, fly it over the campus, and have the flag say "Whips Rule."
Do you guys know how to spell milk toast? It is not spelled with a K. I'm pretty sure. Okay. And you know, somewhere in here you start to see what this isn't. But it isn't this either. There's a narrow way in between these two. And when you think of Jesus as the greatest character the Bible knows, and Moses is certainly one of the top three or four besides that, it's having this characteristic, something very special here. Something very special, I think, to hold on to. Okay? He also tossed in, T.W. Hunt did, terms like weak, cowardly, timid. I think those may come a little closer to the borderline here, because sometimes those are characteristics that are a little closer towards humble, and I think maybe God can work with those. But some of this probably is getting too far outside.
You have to think of Charlie Brown, and you're so wishy-washy.
Many of you know that I've been cleaning out my mother's house. Okay? It isn't hardback, so it's probably not worth as much as it might be. But I found what I think is the first book of Charlie Brown cartoons ever to be published. Plus, I found a very old copy of The Gospel According to Charlie Brown, and I've saved those from my archives. I think those are pretty neat. But some of those early cartoons are very interesting.
What about false humility?
Yeah, there's almost another category, isn't there? And in fact, I think I'm going to argue there's two other categories. So, false humility is one of those. And then, and just sort of set this one aside because it got over there too early. But there's another group of poor me or victim hood. And martyr, I think, is a word that has a richer context. I'm hesitant to put that, but a martyr complex might fall in there. And these are not the same as these. These are not the same as each other, but they represent, I think, perhaps additional categories of this. Using the appearance of humility to manipulate or accomplish things, or simply falling into whatever happens, well, you know, what else could I do? What else could I do? What else could I do? Okay? Now, I want to say, for what it's worth, there is an image that I remember people using where there's a term, gentleness, that's not very far away from this. And the term that I've seen people use when they start down this road of illustration, they don't say gentle. They put a D on it and talk about gentle. I don't think it's the same thing as meekness, but it's close enough that I think it's worth illustrating. And of all things, Joe Cochran in the first hour, many of you will know Joe, told about an illustration that she remembered, and Bob came up afterwards and said, I can remember the conference, I can't remember anything else except this one illustration. And they talked about people a long time ago trying to pick out thoroughbreds to train from a group of horses that had the right lineage to be that sort of thing. And they would train this bunch of horses, and the training was that whenever they heard a certain sound, a trumpet blast of some kind, whenever they heard that sound, they were to stop and go back to the paddock. And they put them on top of a hill and kept them without water for something like 2 days. And there's a body of water at the bottom of the hill. And on the third morning, they open the gates and all the horses go running to the water. Halfway down the hill, they blow the trumpet. The ones that stop and turn back up the hill, those are the ones they took into the second phase of training. Because they said, they have responded to the first level of training. Now, I think that's more with gentleness than it is with meekness, but I think it's close enough that it probably is worth talking about. I want to go to another place.
Some of you will remember that for the last 18 months I've had a different role at the place I work. Some are born great and some have greatness thrust upon them. They made me department chair 18 months ago. And it turns out when you're department chair, there are certain things that are expected of you. One of which is to provide correction to the people that work in your department. I now have some experience with this. So I have some questions to ask you. And I found in the first hour it doesn't work very well for me to ask the question, what do you do when you've been corrected? So let's forget that question. That didn't work in the first hour. What do people do, them, when they're corrected?
These are reactions to correction.
Withdraw.
Are you comfortable with me putting those into a different category from these? Withdrawing and crying in one category, defensive and pride rearing up in another.
Angry. Protective.
Anger. Protective.
Denial.
Denial. The longest river in the world.
Rationalized. How do you cast blame? You start to cast blame on somebody else.
Yeah, how's that worded?
How's that worded? Who are you?
Right, judging his qualifications.
To say that to me. Right.
Some people find room for improvement. They recognize.
It's actually the title of a talk I gave in 1987. Came out of a report card that I got in the 8th grade.
In my school, they gave E for excellence, S for satisfactory, and U for unsatisfactory. And I had E or E plus in everything except phys ed, in which I was never going to get an A. And my father signed the card in the second, in the third quarter, I think it was. And underneath it, in the place for comments, he wrote, "Shows room for improvement."
Okay. Somebody said agree. Make you need to make any specific
plan.
See, room for improvement. Agrees. Accepts.
Learns from.
Appreciates. Jesus. Are you comfortable? Are you comfortable with me putting this in a category of its own? You understand what I'm doing putting this in a category of its own?
Bill, is that kind of predicated on another question, which is that the methods or the tone in which the correction takes place? In other words, if it's a criticism, a put down, you're going to get one set of answers. But if it's constructive feedback, you may initially get the same kind of answers. But then you say, wait a minute, this is something to build on. This is something to offer by someone who's trying to help me do something better tomorrow than I can do it today. Hey, I kind of like that.
Very, very important to make that note. We would have made that note at some point this morning. Because I think that it's vital to understand what I think the Bible is talking about with this word. It's very vital to understand that. I believe that's absolutely true. I think if you offer criticism from a stance that puts you here, neither of those is likely to be very effective. There is a place to stand. It's hard to find, and it's pretty narrow ground. So
But there is a place to stand from which criticism would invite this. And finding that spot may be difficult.
Bill?
Yeah.
The hardest, I speak as an older woman in the body, in these last years, some of the greater wisdom God has revealed is when it doesn't come through the correct response, are you willing to come to me, disregard that, and it's not of it, and receive something that is of it?
That was actually the last point I was going to make once I made that. Yeah. The truth is,
things that are critical are still valid or not valid depending on what you have done. And how it's presented matters. But at the end of the day, that's not all that matters. As I say, when you get finished with this, I think you can see the tightrope pretty clearly.
That narrow way that Jesus talked about. Okay? It's that,
let me invite you to unpack one of these a little bit. Anger. Where would that anger be directed?
I'm speaking from experience within the last 6 weeks.
Within to the deliverer.
How dare you? Or something of that effect.
Anywhere else?
Oftentimes, anger is just a response that comes from hurt.
Fear.
Yeah, but where is it directed?
Self
is the other one that I think is fairly obvious. There is a third one, and I know because I've watched it. And I've watched it more than once with more than one person.
It depends on the severity of the anger within the person receiving it, because you may lash out at the one who delivered it. You may lash it out or at some point to yourself. You also, depending on how severe it is, can lash out to your coworker.
Yeah, but why?
Way
more specific.
And I'm only saying this because I've got at least three examples within the last 6 weeks.
The institution you represent.
Who told you about that? Mm-hmm. Where's the anger directed? You got a problem in your organization. Where do you take that problem? You take that problem to somebody who's supposed to have some authority. What are they supposed to do with it? They're supposed to do something with it. When they begin to do with it and the response is anger, the anger is very often aimed at, where did it come from? And that was something I wasn't prepared for. Looking back, I can see I should have been ready for that, but I wasn't. Caught me very much off guard. In fact, my response was something like this. Why would it ever occur to you to ask that question? What does that have to do with criticism? Is the criticism valid, or is it not valid? If it's valid, never mind how I found out. Maybe I'm omniscient. Maybe I know everything. It turned out that didn't work very well. Do you understand what I'm saying? The easy way to say this is you sort of lash out with blame towards whoever you can find to blame. Right? But it turns out what I've witnessed the last four to 6 weeks is that it's very directed. It's either at the person offering the criticism, or it's at the circumstances. Well, it's not my fault. Look at this and this and this and this. Or it's, how did you even know about this? Somebody talked. And whoever they are, they're going to catch my anger. It turns out it is a tightrope to try to find a way to deflect that back into something productive. And I'll also tell you, it's fairly rare to get this. When you do get this, you can go somewhere. Life can change pretty quickly. And I do not, in any sense, set myself up as an expert, as one who criticizes or tries to correct. I just say it comes with the territory of what I've lived with for the past 18 months. The word I had from one of my colleagues about 2 weeks ago, yeah, we're out here talking about who's next. Interesting question. Because we're just sort of one by one working through where the problems are. And the problems are very unique, and we're trying to do it quietly, but it turns out people go talk.
You know, even though people might not respond initially to that mental problem, your really good employees, that'll be their long-term response. Mm-hmm.
Just talk. Well, the really good employees don't ever need this at all.
Yeah.
I just state that as a fact over my very brief tenure. Yeah.
You know, when you're dealing in a work situation with the boss talked about it, you, that word comes up with that phrase, who told you? I think intellectually that person feels betrayed. And they that feeling reflects back before they say, well, what is the problem? What do we have to do? What are your thoughts? Mm-hmm. They just have that feeling of betrayal. Whether they're right or wrong, but they feel like they're
absolutely right.
Have, and it's at that point they're blinded to continue on in that discussion.
Absolutely right.
My experience, and I'm sure other people.
Absolutely. So. Yeah.
So, I think it's very seldom that, you know, if there's any type of behavior going on in the workforce that's contrary to what the supervisor wants, the employees know what's going on. I mean, it's not anything new. I mean, when you come into the supervisor's office to talk about performance, it's not just something that you and that other person know about. Other people see it going on. They're just wondering, why is it taking you so long to talk to them about it?
I believe that comment has been made more than once. Yeah.
You waiting?
You know what else I think is interesting is that you clearly have been moved to this position with all of your credentials and credibility, and because you're so well respected. And I would think that an organization or community would say, if someone got to receive criticism, better to receive it from someone that they just respect and that commands respect, and they're so knowledgeable and so fill in the blank. And I got to tell you, it's like at the end of the day, I think eventually the good employees will get to that third, that middle column. But it's kind of difficult. If the person standing in their position, it just doesn't matter how much they respect you. That person's response, human response, is going to be not that middle column right away.
Okay. Well, let me take you back to what T.W. Hunt said. Remember, most of the other words we've worked with, there's been one word, one word, one word in these lists, in those lists, right? And even in this list. But today, he's got this long phrase, and only a couple of them, right? One phrase, remember, was lowly before God, humble before men. What I'm suggesting is there's a word that we might put here, which is responsive to correction. Correctable. Responsive to correction. Responsive with somebody in the first hour. And I think they hit something that you guys haven't quite gotten to yet. They put one of the early words here was pensive. They thought about it, and then they came to some of these places. Or if they came to some of these places, they could come to some of these places in a very different tone. You know, well, wait a minute, maybe I've thought about it a bit. I'm not sure you see what I see. Let me explain what things look like from my perspective. Maybe you've not seen that. In which case, a dialogue begins, and there's a whole lot you can do down that road. But they don't. There's not this immediate defensiveness prior to bringing up all the rest of that. And so here's my question. I don't want to address the question to Jesus, because I think this is much more complicated. But look at Moses. If Moses is a person that is responsive to God's correction, and Moses learns from that how that works, then Moses is in a position to provide correction to those that God makes him responsible for. And that works as well. And I think what this scripture verse in Numbers was saying, of all the people on earth, Moses had that working better than anybody else. Responsive to God's correction. And therefore, able to provide correction in the most positive and effective ways to others. And what God was saying was, don't criticize somebody like that. Find out where they're coming from and get in line with them. And that makes it very, very interesting, I think. Here's what I wrote down. What is your reaction when somebody comes to correct you? Do you express anger at the one offering criticism or correction? Do you express anger at the one who informed the one who's offering the criticism? That's coming out of my experiences in the last little while. Or is there a quiet consideration of what you've done that might have led to this moment? And what is an appropriate change that's called for, if anything? That last piece, that's where dialogue can take place. What did Jesus say in Matthew 11? Take my until I was about 8, I always put an L in that word. My ear always heard that word with an L. You know what you get if you put an L in that word? You get eggs. And I never could figure out what that had to do with anything. Okay, what is a yoke designed to do? Where do you put a yoke? You put it on an animal for what purpose? To allow the power and energy of that animal to be focused into a specific task, pulling a plow maybe, or pulling a wagon, right? It's a way of harnessing the power that's inherent in that creature so that that power can do something useful for the one who is the master of that creature. Take my yoke upon you. Learn of me. For I'm meek and lowly of heart. Remember what the...
A double yoke. An oxen that is mature and has been working and knows what to do with a younger oxen that's just learning to work and being led. These yokes so close together that it's... The one moves and the other
moves. Yeah. That's really interesting. Let me go one place first and then come back to that. In the next verse or the verse just before, Jesus says something about his yoke. Do you remember what he says? For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. What I need you to do, if you do those things, you'll find the effort small and the outcome great, as opposed to the effort great and the outcome small. Now let's go back to that. Do you remember Paul talking about people he had worked with and using a phrase like that? I don't remember where it was, but there was some place where he talked about together taking the yoke or something like that. There's a place where they talked about that in parallel. And I think that's a very interesting thing. If you're working alongside of people, that's an interesting image. Matching up maturity with immaturity and letting one learn.
Marriage,
yeah, maybe that's the one I'm thinking about, is that image of marriage. Okay.
Bill,
yeah.
Going back to that correction, because that's a big one.
Huge.
And the word principle. Oh, I just heard the word springing in my mind, vulnerability. Being exposed, being in a position to be collected, being almost naked. First of all, before God, and my first thing had to be laid down, being willing to be vulnerable before God. You are God, I am man. But when you're corrected, you're just exposed. And no matter what wars in you, that you would be gentle, to be pensive, to let God work you through the emotions, to be meek.
I think that's the other word I'm really looking to try to put before you, is responsive. And yeah, there's some correction that when it comes, you feel betrayed by that correction even coming. You feel naked. And when those things happen, what is your normal response? Your normal response is defensiveness and a redoubling of whatever rebellion got you to this point in the first place, right? If you're the one trying to provide the direction, trying to provide the correction, trying to elicit the responsiveness, that's where you don't have control. And that's where tensions in families come from. That's when tensions in work situations come from. These kinds of situations do not exist with all the people that report to me. And there's a bunch of them now. We've grown quite a bit. It comes with a small number. And trying to reach through the barriers and all the rest of that automatically pop up, that's a challenge. It's a big challenge. And something about the way you do it, Ron, I think we're now all the way back to where you were. That's when the way this is offered can be it's not all of it, but it can be the tipping point. If you offer it with a broken heart, a parent to a child, I see what you're doing and I see where it's headed. There's such destruction, such pain down the road. I beg you to trust me enough, trust my wisdom, trust my insight, trust my experience enough to just hear me. You're not going in the right direction. And then all you can do is pray that God opens their heart enough to hear you.
Yes.
And there's a point at which you earn the right to be heard by the validness or the invalidity of the way that you've lived before this. And that's where it gets really tough. And I think that's where I almost have to close out, because I've said about as much as I can say. Randy?
I just often wondered why Jesus chose these particular apostles, and maybe it was because they were responsive, and he knew they were correctable, they were teachable, they would, I don't know, but you wonder why Jesus chose these specific men to entrust the gospel into their hands.
I talked to a parent yesterday at a reception. We had graduation today. Mm-hmm. And I talked to that parent, and I said, your kid, who was still sitting there, wasn't the very best student in the class as far as academic power is concerned. But everything I asked him to do, they did. And I said, that's the mark of future success. You give me somebody who's ready to work the way I ask them to, somebody who's educatable, somebody who's trainable, your kid's going to go a long way. And they've made a good start here. And I mean every word of it. There's, when you have somebody who has academic firepower and also has that, that's when you can hit the moon. But you give me somebody with academic firepower and no discipline and no responsiveness to training, there's not much I can do with them. Whatever skills I have are not worth much. You give me somebody who's got a work ethic, somebody who's responsive, and any of you who are teachers, you know the truth of this. You can generally take them further than the rebellious, academically strong student. And it's an amazing truth. We don't worry quite as much about people who make A's in chemistry. We worry about people who've learned how to be chemists. And usually that means they've been responsive in some way. Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the morning. And we thank you for this complex word. We see all different aspects in this, which perhaps makes sense, since this is an aspect that you specifically allowed Jesus to claim for himself when he was among us. Help us understand your calling for us to be gentle and humble before you, so that when you put us into positions of some authority, we can model your authority of grace and of hope. We ask all these things in your Son's name. Amen.